Welcome to the 110th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Welcome. I hope this finds you well on March. Heart month is over, but it's never over for me. What's going on with my life? Next weekend, I have my Asheville Marathon Challenge. We'll be half marathon on Saturday and a whole marathon on Sunday. So that'll be the first time I've ever done this. So I'm a little bit worried. It'll be probably as much of a mental challenge as a physical challenge, but that's okay. That's what it's all about. I'd like to start by talking about a very positive thing that happened in my office today. Again, the power of plant-based nutrition. I had a call from a podcast listener. Started by saying my brother's to have bypass surgery tomorrow and we want to know what you think. And she sent me his bypass reports and we talked about them and I didn't think that it was emergent. And she had done a wonderful thing for her brother. She went to his home that was a few hours away from hers and brought him back to her house. She had been vegan for years. And she cleaned out her house and made it very whole food, plant-based environment and kind of locked him in the door. And he had terrible diabetes, coronary artery disease, terrible peripheral neuropathy. And over a few short weeks, his neuropathy was improving. His sugars improved to the point where he no longer even needed insulin. We backed off in his blood pressure pills. And he's having no chest discomfort and continues to do well. Of course, he had the side effect of weight loss. And we're just backing off medications and medications. So, you know, it proves one, you know, whole food, plant-based nutrition really does work. She was very diligent about, they were about getting their greens in. And, you know, he was in 100%. He didn't have an opportunity to cheat or gradually go in because he was really up against it. And he got a lot of benefit in a short amount of time because he went so true and so whole into whole food, plant-based nutrition. And it's also, you know, says something for his sister, you know, and they were choked up. You know, he was so appreciative of his sister because, you know, what she had done for him. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure over the years she had tried to speak with him and he just wasn't listening and he had stents placed before. And it took that dire moment for the light bulb to come on and for him to give in and go live with her. And, you know, he talked about staring at the refrigerator, opening the door up, and there wasn't anything that he's usually used to eating in there. And he came back a few times, and then he finally started eating the, you know, the carrots and the raw vegetables and the fruit. And, you know, he was amazed at how well he felt, and he felt good quickly. And, you know, he was eating fruit. So, you know, the diabetics out there that have been told that you can't eat fruit, you can't eat potatoes, it's just not true. All the oil was eliminated from their diet. He had all the greens and fresh fruits and vegetables, and he did really, really good. So, you know, I'm really proud of them, and it's nice to see, you know, and hear success stories. So I thought I'd like to share that with you. This week, I'm really excited for the podcast because I want to share with you a couple things that have happened that really tied in together. You know, I'm very much a believer that you know, you run into things just at the right time and things happen at the right time. And I was on Facebook and I saw a reference to a vegetable powder. And I also had someone in my class ask me about, you know, other vegetable powders such as beet powder and all this other kind of thing. And I've never been much of a fan of something dehydrated. I really like the real thing, but you know, nevertheless, I thought I would, you know, start to do some of my own research about, you know, is this vegetable powder an alternative, you know, if people don't like vegetables or to supplement their diet, is there anything to it? The other thing that I want to talk about is Lent and the possibilities of plant-based nutrition and a great way to transition. And then the last thing I'll touch on is moving your body. But to get back to this vegetable powder thing, so the first thing I went and started thinking about, well, how do they actually make this stuff? You know, so they dehydrate vegetables, But if you look on the sites, there's no real, the chemical process that, you know, a large manufacturer uses wasn't really listed. But I came upon a do-it-yourself type vegetable powder, and they were talking about, you know, they took excess vegetables and even some of their compost and then dried them and then ground them up and used them as vegetable powder. And first thing that comes to mind is when they said compost vegetables, and then I took that back to the, you know, the commercially made ones. You know they're not going to take the vegetables that, and maybe at first they did, but, you know, the reality of it is they're not going to have vegetables that are the pristine organic vegetables, and knowing where the sources came from, because you have to use so many. So right away, your source is going to be goofy, and then, or, you know, it's not accurate, or there's no way to be able to tell where those vegetables came from. And then the process of dehydrating or drying, whatever, you know, chemical process, depending on the heat and what's used, you know, you're losing a lot of nutrients. And then the possibility of a lot of contaminations, because there's been numerous supplements that have found to have things that they shouldn't have, such as growth factors and growth hormones. And then there are other supplements that haven't had anything what they said they were going to have. So there's no way of telling, because it's certainly not regulated. And the process itself, you know, determining how many, what nutrients are there is very, very difficult. So that left me, you know, certainly doubting a lot. And so I kept researching, and I came upon a great article, and it talked about the development of, and I'll cite the reference in the show notes, but it talked about basically the beginnings of chlorella, which is, you know, deemed these days as a potential superfood, and it's in a lot of these green powders, and it's from an algae, and it first started to be developed in 1940s, right after the war. You know, the Malthusian trap, when people were talking about, you know, we're going to now have this population explosion after the war, and we have all these starving people, and how will we ever feed them with the way the crops are growing? Because again, back in the 40s, we hadn't started the monocrop, so there were, you know, all these diversified crops. People ate things that were local and in season, and how would we ever feed, you know, that we had a large portion of starving people, in the world after the war. So what will we possibly do? And there was a group out of the sponsored by the Carnegie Institute and conducted by the Stanford Research Institute in Palo Alto, as well as the Arthur D. Little Incorporation in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And basically, they noted that the chlorella could use photosynthesis to produce a lot of nutrients, and there wasn't much in the way of waste. So chlorella could take extract 20% of the solar energy versus 1% from conventional plant foods like, you know, soybeans and corn. And so when it was dried and processed, there could be a 50% amount of protein, which was, you know, the chlorella contained 50% protein, and it was a complete protein. Also had a lot of calories in it and fat in it, and it was thought to be, you know, a superfood as far as feeding the population. And the NIH and Dean Burke actually got involved, and they projected that, you know, this stuff you could produce 17 to 40 tons per acre, and that would translate into 17,000 to 40,000 pounds per acre versus 17 pounds from soy, and the cost would be like 25 cents a pound. So you could envision a crop plantation the size of the state of Rhode Island could feed the whole world, using about 20 workers, and, you know, they foresaw these glass pipelines with a few people working them, and that, you know, it would take less people, and it would feed lots of people, and everything would be great. And there was a publication in the Science newsletter that said there is no question in the minds of scientists that the forms of the future will act. The farms of the future will actually be producing carbohydrate and protein from microorganisms. And then Science Digest said this common pond scum would be feeding the world's, so that this chlorella would become one of the most important crops that we have. One of the most interesting quotes I saw was from a gentleman called M.K. Burnett, and he was the executive director of Stanford University's Food Research Institute. And he cautioned that if food production didn't increase rapidly, the white races might eventually be eating an unpalatable Asian-style diet based on grains and legumes with little or no animal protein. And it says, while such cuisine is now considered quite healthful, post-war alarmists dismiss such coolie rations as fit for peasants and animals, but certainly not meat-loving Americans. So I thought that was, a great quote that, you know, again, even back then, certainly we don't want to eat plants. We have to have our meat as an American culture. And it just drives home that the social aspects of food is so important when we consider how to feed people. We can talk all day long about, you know, you need to eat to survive, as to eat pleasurably, but you know, in the end, it's really not going to work. Then they figure, well, okay, so people aren't going to eat these algae, this slime, this powder. So we'll give it to the animals, and that will increase their protein, so we can produce more animals for people to eat. Because to make chlorella, you need sun, water, carbon dioxide, algae, and sewage. So, This would even, you know, pay for itself, that you could use sewage and runoff to make this, you know, superfood to feed the animals, and that maybe the startup prices would be high, but, you know, soon it would pay for itself. And it all kind of backfired because the price to produce grains actually decreased because the production increased with the advent of better fertilizers and irrigation, and of course the price because of transportation the price decreases. And then it turned out that the algae production turned out to be much more costly. From 1950 to 1990, the population doubled in size from 2.6 billion to 5.3 billion. However, the food production grew even faster. Soybean production increased by sixfold. Grain production increased by twofold. There was 150% more grain produced by acre. In the United States alone, the production tripled. So since there were 40% more grain and 300% more soy, we didn't need, and the population didn't rise. So the hungry population, the people that were, you know, in need of calories was down to 15% from post-war 50%. And the algae price actually cost more than $1,000 per ton in 1990, which was 100 times more than they projected it 40 years early. So it really kind of backfired a little bit. The other thing that happened was the photosynthetic efficiency of producing chlorella wasn't quite as they thought it was going to be. You know, it was more like 25% as opposed to 50 to 70%, if that. And Pfizer Laboratories entered into it, and they found that chlorella actually only converted 25% of the light into carbohydrates. If it did that in the lab, but in sunlight, it's only 2.5%, and it might even be worse. It also needed, a lower twilight level. Artificial illumination worked best. It didn't grow well crowded, so it had to have a lot more input than it was thought for, you know, more people working on it. It produced better if you had carbonated water, so that cost more to have carbonated water pump in. And then there was also this big contamination issue with other molds and bacteria. And it was very temperature sensitive, and to harvest it, it required centrifuges and coagulants. And it was a very difficult drying and processing. So this brings up a huge point that, you know, okay, so we take this chlorella that's supposed to be the superfood. It can be very contaminated. It's very sensitive as far as to light and then the processing is so much more difficult. So you can start to see that although it may be a superfood, once you start to process it, bad things start to happen. So, you know, they were left with kind of a nasty little green vegetable and what to do with it. So they, you know, they said they have to remove the seaweed taste and the green color so people might eat it. That also took away the vitamins and minerals, so they had a plan. The other thing, it would turn rancid really quick and lose its nutritional value, so that was another problem. So in 1950, Pfizer said, it costs 48 cents a pound under the best conditions to make chlorella, but realistically it was about $1 a pound once you did all the processing to it. And soy was now down to 6 cents a pound. So they turned their attention to spirulina in 1960, hoping that that might be a source, and it's because it was easier to process. But the other thing that happened in 1960 is the Green Revolution and birth control pills and Julia Child and the Kennedy and the onset of gourmet food and people wanting to eat, fancy foods, and the population explosion was actually less. So that market really declined. But the United States and the Soviets were competing for their space program, and they thought that maybe chlorella could be an astronaut food because they were anticipating long space flights. And they thought, well, you know, this algae might be a way to actually use the sewage from the astronauts to turn into food. So Boeing, Martin Marietta got into it. They funded some research. But it turned out that the contamination problems with producing the spirulina was just too great, and the space flights were going to be much shorter, so that was abandoned as well. So that's when spirulina and chlorella became health foods, and it cost $1,000 a ton to make these things, and so they became nutritional supplements sold in grocery stores and health food stores for $30 to $50 a pound. In 1980, Asian factories were making most of it at 2,000 tons a month. It was marketed as weight control, cancer prevention, immune stimulants. In 1960, spirulina was also found in Saharan Lake and in Mexico in a lake, so they thought they could process it a little bit simpler. But again, it stayed into the health food market. The other thing, you know, the government was turning its, and industry was turning its sights towards making genetically modified organisms to increase crop production. They were also looking at genetic engineering to make super farm animals, big chicken breasts and all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of where the tide turned. So if we move forward to today and the development of all these powders, be it, you know, a beet powder or multi-vegetable powder, it's kind of the same thing. You know, how to make these powders that are appealing, that taste great, that cost less. And if you start to think about the sourcing of it, it's got to come from cheap vegetables, if not early on, later on. Who knows what kind of vegetables. The mass production of it, depending on the process of it, you're going to lose a lot of nutritional value. Nobody knows the stability of these things. You know, it comes with a little silicone pack in some of these containers. Nobody knows how long before, any of the nutrients become rancid or lose their value. So we're back to eating whole foods. And if you think about it, $50 for a little carton of this stuff, yeah, it might be handy, but you don't know the quality of it. And you can buy a lot of really nice vegetables for $50. So I'm going to encourage you to stay away from the powders of all types. You don't need them. They're processed. As Dr. Campbell says, in his book called The Whole, you know, our body has a bunch of biochemical reactions all the time, and there's no way that you can tease out these nutrients and make them go in the right places. Our body knows how to use whole foods. It doesn't know how to use parts of foods and remanufactured powders of foods that change the absorption rate. So, you know, again, go back to the old-fashioned way. And if you, you know, trigger that back, you know, think about the Blue Zones and the people of Icaria and Sardinia. You know, they live simple lives. They raise their gardens. They eat food that they can identify. They walk. Life hacks don't work if you want to live to be 100 and live to be well. We're entering springtime and a time of the Easter and the Lent season. Other religions also have times of fasting. It's springtime, you know, a time of cleansing. And, you know, if I focus a little bit more on, you know, maybe Lent, it started, you know, the Lenten season, the different days of fasting, I guess in older times, you know, then we progress to fish on Friday and some days of fasting in between. But if we just look at fasting, and a lot of the Jewish holidays also incorporate fasting as a time of reflection. So you take food out of the picture, and you know, if you ever have done a prolonged fast. It does take, food takes up a tremendous amount of time, whether you're thinking about what you're going to make, gathering the food to make it, whether you're going to the grocery store, the preparation, the cleanup. It's a tremendous amount of time in your day. And if you take that out, it does free up a whole lot of time for whatever. And, you know, I think it's a, you know, especially a one-day fast is completely doable for just about anybody. If you're on insulin or you know other diabetic agents, it can you know certainly want to take those when you're fasting. But you know a day of fasting or even a half a day of fasting can do your body a whole lot of good, just because of the digestive rest that it gets, and you can clean your body, cleanse your body in fluid and drink water. You know, you don't have to worry about drinking juices. You can, water's fine for a day. You'll get along just good. And, you know, for the Easter season, if somebody wanted to do a half a day fast, I think it's a great time to try something like that. Again, if you're a diabetic, you want to make sure that you're not taking your medications. You may want to take your blood pressure, because if you are doing this, even the half day of fasting, because you're eliminating so much sodium consumption potentially, your blood pressure may drop and you may not need your blood pressure medicines after especially a couple of weeks or maybe that day. So it's always a good to monitor yourself if you're taking medications. Might not also be a good time to have your cholesterol checked before and after so that you can see yourself that if you did a half a day of fasting one day a week, what effect it may have. Because it actually might help you to rid your body of some cholesterol. The other thing, you know, with the traditions in religions that give up meat for a day or for a time period, I had a patient that substituted that with a tremendous amount of cheese. And I don't think that's the idea of it. It's just elimination of something, not the addition of something. People, you know, are so afraid that they're going to not get the nutrients that they need for a day. And we turn to cheese as a potential source of calcium and protein. But the reality of it is it's just a source of salt, fat, and oil. So, you know, if you're going to not eat meat on one of the days during the, you know, this religious season, then consider eating more vegetables or just consider eating less of everything and just eliminate the meat from the plate so that you can see what wasn't there. And then you could think about, well, what would you put there instead? And again, I would suggest that be vegetables. I had a great wrap this week that was, I actually got it at a restaurant that they did grilled asparagus, Swiss chard, mushrooms, red peppers, There was one other vegetable. But it was very, very tasty. That was all it was in. It was vegetables. I think there were onions in it. So, I mean, that's a great way to change your wrap, you know, up. You don't even need, you know, beans in it. If you want to just do vegetables for a day, that would be a good alternative as well, is just to do a day of fruit and vegetables. Eliminate, you know, even eliminate your grains for a day. If you were just not quite wanting to do a fast, but wanting to cut back a little bit more extreme. I worked with the chef at the Twin Isles Country Club where we had our conference with to prepare him to make our no oil, no sugar, no salt food for our conference. And he got it. At first he, you know, was scratching his head as far as how he was going to make, you know, especially large amounts to serve a lot of people and kind of alter the way his traditional cooking method was. And I've also kept in contact with the chef we used last year. And he, you know, was very good at not using any oil, and he worked at a restaurant that I recommended a lot of people go to, and he would not use oil to cook. But, you know, we were speaking yesterday and talking about if you go to a restaurant and you ask for no oil and you don't know the chef or know who's actually preparing it, there's a good chance that the people in the back are going to use oil. It's just so much handier for them. You know, he told me about at a place that he works now, and you know, they were using all this oil to make these, and it was a health food store that they were making these in a deli, and they were making these egg white omelets, and how much oil they were using in the pan, you know, to flip these egg white omelets. So when people go and they think they're getting a something from a restaurant, you got to be really careful, because that can be a really big source of oil, even though, you know, your waitress may say, you know, no, it's, there's no oil. Oh, sure, we won't do it for you. So you really have to kind of look at your food, and you can tell, you know, you can tell by looking at the plate, if there's been oil on it. You know, and certainly going back to this egg white omelet, there's, you know, there's no benefit in eating egg whites and, you know, as used to wrap your vegetables. If you go to breakfast with someone and they're serving omelets, ask for the vegetables to be just cooked by themselves. And, you know, I've asked for a veggie omelet without the egg. And so you do the peppers and the mushrooms and the onions and get some, you know, you could get some potatoes and ask them to just toss them without oil. And you can tell if they're greasy when you come out, then you've gotten into a bunch of oil. So just, you know, an FYI, after talking to the chef, there's a lot of things that go back, that happen back in the kitchen that you're not aware of. And you know, last night we ate at a restaurant that was an Indian Burmese fusion restaurant. And again, we've eaten there with our meetup group, and we've spoken to her about not using oil and vegetable broth if there's any broth involved. And they become very good at that. You know, you just kind of have to mention to your server, you know, it's vegetable broth, right? And you're not going to do oil, right? And you're going to steam the tofu, right? You know, and so they're very good to comply once they know your wishes. Especially if you've had a chance to meet the chef and then praise them. And, you know, a little extra tip goes a long way, too, to have them appreciate, because they're doing a little extra work for you. So, you know, reward them for their efforts. And the more you reward them for their efforts, the better chance you have of getting what you want in the future there. And if we take it into people that are new to being plant-based, the transition can be really hard. I see it in my class. Sometimes people just look overwhelmed at what to do. I've had a lot of good feedback recently from the class. One couple's actually taking it again, and they've been to several of my conferences and talks, and they really do get it, and now they're starting to, she's the cook, and she's starting to feel very comfortable at preparing the foods and preparing for other people. And they both lost weight, and they both feel great. But it's taken a while to be comfortable with the conversion. And I was listening to another podcast that talked a good bit about mental training and mental toughness with a Navy SEAL trainer and talked about Zen counting and just the breath and counting and learning to sit quiet and counting, you know, two breaths and keeping your mind focused on your breath and working your way up. If you can count to, you know, one, two, and if you lose your breath, if you lose your concentration, then you start again and you breathe again and you count. And if you lose your concentration, you start again. And it could take months to get up to 12, 13, 14 without losing, you know, your focus on your breath. Your mind starts to wander and various things happen. And, you know, I think that's it's a great practice. I also heard another podcast and, you know, another talk about, you know, the one thing that we do every day, 25,000 times a day is breathe. And I watch people in my office all the time breathe very shallow. And they're just, and if you think about your lungs, you know, being, you know, about this, the height of a bucket, you know, not as big as a gallon bucket, but a quart bucket, you know, on both sides. And people are just breathing, you know, about a third of it most of the time. So if you can start to take time of your day and breathe in through your nose, and when you breathe in through your nose, it's much slower and you fill up your whole lung capacity. And you breathe through your diaphragm, not just with your shoulders coming up in the top part of your chest, but you fill your whole chest up. And then you want to exhale very slowly. There's different ways to breathe and different techniques and different breathing patterns for different things. But just to focus on breathing in for a period of time and then breathing out slower and try to double it, maybe, you know, three to six, you know, as far as counting three in and breathing six out. But more than that, even just throughout the day, taking deep breaths in to really expand your lungs and let the air in, I think is extremely important. And if you've ever lost your cool, you know, and you've taken a couple times and you could just kind of breathe it off, and you can settle yourself down if you just give yourself a moment to take some breaths and take a little bit of a time out. But it's a practice that you have to do, and again, you know, these people that you know that you can look it up as far as people to do underwater diving and breath holding and things like that. It's a training process that you have to train to and work yourself up to, and it's not entirely different from, you know, training to be plant based. It takes steps. And then you lose your concentration, and you take more steps, and you lose your concentration. And there's so many distractions out there when you're becoming plant-based. You go to the grocery store, and there's, you know, you're in the produce section, but next thing you know, there's a bag of, you know, snap peas that have cheese on them, or something, you know, that are fried, whatever. And you get distracted, or there's something prepared and you think, well, this might be good because it's, you know, it has a health food name on it, or it says it's vegan. Or you get distracted with friends when you go out. So you have to keep bringing your focus back and bringing yourself back to whole food and plant-based and what is it that you want to accomplish. And you know, the idea is to eat whole plant foods in their most natural form without oil and salt. And certainly limit your sugar intake and limit the processed foods. But it's not going to happen right up front. And it might not even be that enjoyable as far as the preparation. In the class, you know, trying to make more focus on, you know, how do you chop up vegetables to make it quicker? You know, certainly having a good knife and getting everything lined up, you can cut up things in half the time. You also can cut up things in half the time when you practice. So it's the preparations a practice, the food purchasing is a practice, the food prep is a practice, and dealing with other people is a practice. You know, I still have difficulty, especially with my colleagues. It just irritates me to no degree when I'm sitting in the doctor's lounge and they come in, and it's not so much if they're eating it, but it's what they project. What I see is they are projecting to their patients, and they're setting such a poor example by not caring what they feed themselves. And then, of course, there's the dialogue with what am I eating? You know, my fruit and oats and nuts, you know, so I'm the perception of me being, you know, this granola girl and not, you know, being silly about what I'm eating and limiting myself. And, you know, when we start to talk about health and, you know, if there's a cancer doctor and he shows me his wife's cholesterol and it's all off the board and, you know, should she start statins? And it's hard for me not to lose it, you know, and I do lose it. And I'll say, you know, it's all about nutrition. You know, you need to eat plant-based. And, you know, I'll dive right into it because I don't give them the watered-down version or I don't give them the kind slow version that I might give my students, you know, because I expect so much more out of them. And, you know, so I've kind of grabbed myself and, you know, they all come back with the same response. Well, we eat pretty healthy, but I know that they don't because they have no perception of what they're eating. They think as long as it's expensive, it's healthy. So I need a different approach with them. And I would do better to, you know, maybe take a couple breaths before I answer the questions. And, you know, it's something that I have to focus on. So this whole process or this practice, you know, continues to go on with the people that you meet, your social environment, and, you know, even your physicians as far as getting off medications. Because sometimes when you're trying to get off medications, the physician just sees you as obstinate, you know, that you just don't want to be compliant. Because there's studies out there, people, that, you know, when doctors write prescription that the patient may fail the first one, but up to 25% don't fail the second prescription, you know? And so how can we help people if they won't fill their prescriptions? So there's this dichotomy between, you know, patient and physician. We're trying to help and you won't comply. So, you know, that practice between, you know, it has to go on and so between the doctor and the patient. So it takes a dialogue for you to be able to explain that, you know, that you feel much better and you're eating plants and you're getting nutrients, and to be able to explain yourself takes time. At first, it's just a source of frustration and it may be a source of intimidation because a lot of people don't want to talk to their physician about nutrition because they assume that their physician understands nutrition and they're going to be able to debate with them, but it's just certainly not true. Week about a physician, and it's like it was in a newsletter that's put out a couple times a week, sponsored by drug companies, that talked about a leading physician saying that nutrition doesn't matter as far as cardiovascular disease. Well, that's crazy, you know, and he cited, you know, these different studies that were very poor studies that may have changed things just a little bit or decreased saturated fat and increased simple carbohydrates in the form of sugars and breads. You know, so they're not good studies. So they, you know, instead of looking to the Esselstyn studies or the Ornish studies, they were never even brought up. So, you know, people cherry pick to, you know, publish their own studies and it's or not to publish their own studies, but for their own values. You know, I'm sure this guy was a meat loving interventional kind of guy that he certainly doesn't want to, you know, give any credit to nutrition changing disease when, you know, the way he practices is completely opposite of that. It throws a big wrench into the practice of your practice. Heard over and over from physicians that become plant-based is, you know, kind of once you see the light, you got to change the whole way you practice. You can't go back to this prescription writing, procedure doing type of practice all day long. It takes, you know, you want to talk to people and you want to, just like you do when you become plant-based, you want to tell everybody that there's a different way, and it takes a lot of time. So it also takes the development of a comfort level from a physician's aspect. Because again, just like that practice, you practice a certain way for a lot of years, you have to develop a way to practice plant-based nutritional medicine as well so that you approach people differently. You know, it's the same for everybody. You get excited and you want to tell everybody, but there's different approaches. Not everybody wants to hear it straight on. And especially when you're starting to talk about things that, you know, well, what do you mean? I didn't cause my own disease. You know, I've eaten this way for years. So you don't want to attack anybody, but it's a practice. So even though I get very excited and I want my patients to change immediately in the class, and you know, certainly the sicker they are, the more benefit they get out of change. I have to pull myself back and realize that it's a practice, and that sometimes small steps towards a bigger goal actually has more benefit in the long run than to try to do this all in one and then fall off. So, you know, I want everybody to do as much as they possibly can, as quick as they can, but I also want to reward and celebrate the small steps along the way, because that's really where the foundation is being laid. And then you can morph that practice into everything. And, you know, the next step is movement and keeping mobile. When I watch people walk on a treadmill, or I watch people walk into a grocery store and they're leaning on the cart, or when people are walking on the treadmill and they're bent like a C, or people are walking in, you know, various ways that they've become bent over the years because of stiffness and immobility, and people don't even notice it. And I'll ask them if something hurts, you know, it's my patients, not people walking into the grocery store. And they'll say no. And I'll, you're walking bent over, and, you know, try to tuck under it, and they become conscious of it, and they, you know, they'll try to change their movement. But I think that, again, bringing your movement into your awareness is very important. And changing your mobility, again, is a small step increment to try to keep working on it. And I believe that you can become very mobile. Again, it's, you know, even at 50, 60, 70, but it's a matter of working on it and breaking some of these adhesions and just doing a daily practice of mobility. And I'm finding, you know, the best way to do that is to, or even to assess that, is your ability to do a simple squat. You know, and Google a picture of a child in a squatting position and see how they're sitting very comfortably. You know, they'll be all the way down with their butt almost on the ground, and they'll be sitting straight up, and they'll be working with their hands, or, you know, holding an object without any strain at all. And then try that yourself by keeping your back straight and bending down from behind and keeping, you know, upright as you go down, and see how far you can go down, and can you go down and hold that all the way down. And it may be such that you can't get down there slowly, but if you get down and you can hold on to something, and so you can feel all those stretches in your hips and in your back, and it's a great thing to do, even if you just get down and hold it, as opposed to down and up and down and up. Or work your way down when you're doing, a squatting routine or exercise. Instead of bending over to get something, squat down to get it, so that every time you bend down, you're actually increasing your mobility, and it gives you a time to stretch over the day. You know, I've heard people, athletes, talk about, you know, that they heal so much and they stretch for hours in the day. And of course, if you've watched any ballerinas, they do a whole lot of stretching and mobility, and, you know, and track people do a whole lot of stretching and mobility. But as we become adults and busy with our daily lives, we don't do it. So we get fixed in the positions that we do most of the day, which is unfortunately sitting or crumbling up into the couch or into a soft chair. So take some time to assess your mobility and see how far you can get down in this squat position and hold it. And, you know, and then various, you know, you can do it with your legs shoulder width apart, your legs together, your legs wide apart. It stretches different parts of your body. And see, you know, see just how much mobility that you've lost, and you should be straight up. The other thing is to stand with your toes against a wall and your arms up on the wall, and then squat down and see if you can stay there, how far you can get, because that makes you keep upright. So, again, just getting your arms above your head and your shoulder mobility. Our upper backs get really tight by sitting all day. So increasing your shoulder blade and your shoulder mobility helps a tremendous amount. And if you can get on the ground and you do some foam rolling on your back, or they sell these really soft balls that you can roll on, it will help tremendously. And if you think about, we have this fascial surface from our heads to the bottom of our feet, that we're all kind of connected, that kind of tapes us together, or tapes all our muscles together, so to speak. And when this gets all tight and stuck down, it causes all kinds of problems. So problems in your hip can result in pain in your feet. Problems in your shoulders can result in pain in your head. So a lot of headaches, you know, we looked all over our head and people get CAT scans and all these crazy things. And the headaches are actually caused by just fascial tension, muscle tension, decrease of neck mobility, and different postures. You know, millions of dollars are spent on medicines to treat things that may be improved with, you know, just improving your mobility. So to try to focus on that, it doesn't require a fancy gym. And I think the machines are even worse than just to do body movements because these machines don't allow you to move naturally. So, you know, Tai Chi, yoga, but just simple stretching and mobility, you know, in your own house is a wonderful thing. And again, I'm still doing my push-ups. And I've, you know, I'm now doing 80, 85 a day. I break them up after 40, 10 to 15 at a time. A couple days a week, I'm doing 100. But I'm also focusing on how I'm doing them now. So at first, when I started doing a push-up, my elbows were out, and I still tried to maintain the mobility. So I go all the way down. So it's you know, just to do 100 little inch push-ups, it's not good. You want to, again, the mobility all the way down and all the way up. So if you have to go from your knees, go from your knees. If you have to go from the wall, go from the wall. But continue to expand your mobility. Now I have my arms back, and you know, so there's different positions that I want to work different muscles with the push-ups. But it's helping tremendously as far as my strength. And if I go to do a bench press or something, it's much easier now. My mobility is much better, and it's become a practice. At first, it was that 22-day challenge. And then I decided to take it out and post it on Facebook. And then, you know, it got to be boring for people to see. So I quit putting it on Facebook. So every once in a while I'll say, okay, I posted that I did 100 push-ups. It's not to brag. It's just to check in that I'm still doing them. And it's become a practice after about 3 months. It's something that, you know, I'll say, you know, I really don't want to do it today. But then I'll start and I'll do it. So I've only missed, you know, one day in the last 4 months. It's because I plain forgot while traveling. But so it becomes very important. And most of the time I do them after my run in the morning. So I get them done. If I wait, then that's when I start to forget them. So if you're going to try to do a practice that you do every day, then pick a certain period of time that you do and allot that time for it. And I think marking things on a calendar is really good. No matter what you do, just a little jot. It doesn't have to be a big journaling if you don't want to, but just a little, I did this many of what, and it keeps you accountable and you can look back and trace your progress. So that's about all I have for today. Next weekend I'm doing the half in the hole, so the podcast may not come out till the following week, but I'll keep you informed and maybe just do a race report after that event. So until then, make little steps towards your big goal. Eat your vegetables, drink your water when you're thirsty, and move a little bit. Thank you.